to continue because I can't see you. Oh, there you go. Matt, how are you? Sorry, I'm a bit late.
No, not at all. I was also watching the announcements and checking out everything as well. So I sort of expected it, given you run a topical news show. I was like, this is probably priority one for you at the moment.
No, we assumed we'd be losing our audience and our OB days. And yeah, we're kind of used to it now.
Yeah, no, I guess at this point you've done an entire season down an audience. You have a bit of a feel for it, although I'm sure it is, you're keen to get people back in.
Yeah, it does make a difference because if you, just in terms of performing, there's an immediate, validation of the material and satisfaction once you've done the show and you get a round of applause, and then you go and sit in the edit for, several hours and put it all together. But that feels like a different thing.
Oh, no, I totally
Without the audience, it just feels like yet another stage in making it. It's as interesting as it is, sadly. I mean, actually, the most pleasurable is writing.
Yeah.
Performing has its rewards, but when you don't have the audience there, it just feels like a technical thing.
Yeah, no, I totally feel that. When I've had to learn the full-length stand-up shows for myself, for festivals, sometimes I'll record a set and I'll cut it together with stuff that haven't really got a nice recording of from a set. So the pieces will go me talking to myself, nice piece with audience, fully performed, and then transition back into me talking to myself. And it's just a strange little feeling of my own to be like, oh, well, I know that bit works. This next bit will land well. So,
I mean, they give you permission to do the things you do, and then you do extra things because they're there.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of a dance you do with that group of anonymous people who you don't really know, and they're relating to you in a singular way, but you're relating to them en masse, which is a kind of impersonal and this blob in the dark, basically, that you're dancing with, So it's a fascinating, intricate and never-endingly wonderful puzzle, I think, all this performing and writing and starting again.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially at the pace that you're working at on a show like this. It's, it exists and you create this like really wonderful piece of material that then immediately has to be discarded that you can start again.
But that's all right. Most of my stuff is like that, like over the years, and this will gently get us into talking about the early days of community radio / television. But the idea that something isn't going to be forever and is kind of, in the way that it should be with performance, it's a moment for that audience that's present with you at that time, and then it's gone and disappears. But if you you are sitting down recording something for the purpose of seeing it later or seeing it forever, you do approach it in a completely different way. You feel the weight of it, and you also feel like it's more important than it actually is, because of course none of it's important at all.
Wow!
So doing something in weekly turnaround is a bit like doing a show that's never going to be recorded in front of an audience. In a way, it's kind of it's done, it's finished with, and then it disappears. Of course, it never does because of iView and the internet, and that's true of any theatre performance. And as Michael Richards will tell you, someone with an iPhone camera in your audience means you can't really risk something, or you can't get permission from that audience in the room that says, oh yeah, you can behave like this. Not that I'm actually convinced he got that permission, but you know what I mean? There's a kind of a context that's created by the moment, which regrettably recording and then republishing kind of robs you of.
Yeah,
it was a great what's his name? He wrote Art and the Mechanical Age of Reproduction. Walter Benjamin. You heard of Walter Benjamin?
No.
He talks about how the act of recording or copying or that process of preserving alters entirely the intention and the nature of the thing you're making.
Mm.
A whole bunch of things just disappear. One of the great things about the really early days for me doing community radio in Adelaide was that we did a lot like Mad as Hell. It was every week. It was like a Saturday. I'd go in and we'd do a half-hour written show every week. And it was a like a like a goon show, basically, or like a comedy drama, or it's a harp, mainly sketches. So it's not, in many ways, not dissimilar from Mad as Hell. But it'd basically be written on the Friday night and then performed live with sound effects and, you know, that sort of stuff. And then I'd tape it on a cassette so I could listen to it in the car afterwards and then put it in the shed. And that was basically it. But that the discipline that we imposed on ourselves to do that every week was invaluable, because you end up with a set of muscles that can do that thing, can make the show every week. Whether it's good or bad doesn't really matter, really. It's just that you actually are match fit to do that thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you used to, I don't know, you know, in your case, stand up, for me, it's sketch. You know, that's what I'm used to writing. And I can do that thing of folding it in a number of different ways to suit whatever the audience is. So I can do that for a television show. I can do it for a radio show. Probably still could do it. I could do it on stage if I had the wherewithal and time to do something for the comedy festival or whatever.
Mm.
You know, it kind of gets more collaborative as you move into performing in front of a mass audience. So it's pretty much just you and the sound guy and whoever's in charge of the light.
Yeah.
If you're doing a gig in a venue.
Yeah.
And then it becomes increasingly, I always say, it's a bit like suddenly you've got 150 people telling the same joke when you're in TV, and to a lesser extent radio as well. In fact, radio, you're probably slightly more in control because there's less moving parts to it.
Yeah.
But the beauty of the television, which I never got to do, I never got to do community television, although, as you observed, I kind of supported and participated younger friends who were writers, usually, who were doing stuff. Stephen Hall started off doing a show called Under Melbourne Tonight, I think. He might have been a co-presenter of that, and that's where I first came across him. Having to end up speaking the same language so that your joke or whatever you're presenting is shepherded through this rather intricate system of lenses and edits and things like that. It's just great. It's a great experience, and you end up speaking this. You end up being able to communicate with people, and then when you do it for a living, then you're already ready. You've already got those muscles already flexed and developed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The time that I've spent in community television has been invaluable time, because I've gone from researching and writing to head writing episodes to line producing The Leak for an entire season, and just being able to, like you've mentioned, being able to put that to all the moving pieces together within a week,
yes,
and ensure that everybody is where they need to be and that they're getting the support that they need, and that you are in essence creating a language together, which I'm sure as you move up changes a little bit, but you know, you've
it probably doesn't. I mean, the great thing about this business is that it's so genuinely egalitarian. You can come into it through any door, from any angle, at any age, and with any or no experience. You can, it is true. I can't think of any other profession or job where the rewards are so great, and you can come in through, it's just this permeable membrane. You can come in through anywhere to get inside it. And it's really good for that reason. And when I wanted to switch from what I was doing, which was being a lawyer, to being an entertainer,
yeah,
I did try and I thought, oh, well, I'll learn how to do editing. This is my foresight. I thought, oh, yeah, in that day it was analog editing anyway, so it would have been a skill that would have been completely redundant in about 2 years had I done it. But I'm sure I would have picked up other things. But I applied to enter the Australian Film Television School in a postgraduate editing course. I felt that my university degree, such that it was, would enable me to get a postgraduate course. Anyway, I didn't get in. I couldn't get in anywhere. I was not wanted. I was almost 30 at that point. So the only way in was, you know, obviously I'd picked up some ragbag technique and understanding basically of how to record things and, you know, some radio, record things and replay them, but that was about it. I kind of knew something about timing and recreating what you do on stage. repeating it a number of times and being able to kind of know where you are when you're doing it backwards and all out of order and that sort of thing. Because that's probably the, as a performer, that's the skill that you need to have under your belt when you decide to work in front of a camera, is that the things that you do naturally on stage in front of an audience, in the order in which you do them, you might have to, I don't know, it's just more artificial, and you've got to throw yourself back into them, pretend there is an audience there basically, and make sure you've got that energy that you would have when you're performing. All those things, if you've got that under your belt by the time you stand in front of a camera, then you know, that's valuable. No, I can't remember my original point now. I've drifted off.
Well, I guess that's a segue into community TV a little bit. One of those nice skills would be you often don't have an audience on a community TV audience, so you are performing for nobody. So that's an ingrained, inbuilt skill that you're bringing forward.
Yeah, you are. You're performing in front of this sort of dead bit of machinery, you know, that's that you're pretending is a person, essentially, because you. And it's a very intimate relationship, because you're looking down the barrel, talking directly to the person on the other end of the television set or the computer screen. And that was one of the things I did when I was on Full Frontal. I deliberately started writing material where I was talking down the barrel. First of all, it was easy to remember because it's on auto cue.
Yeah.
I don't have to remember it. But also it was the way to get noticed, because if you're doing sketch all the time, like I was, you're being observed, being a character, whereas it's as soon as you turn and look at the person at home in the eye, you're kind of their friend a bit. You know, they kind of think they know you more, at least they know who you are, or they want to know what your name is or whatever. So it was a very deliberate attempt to just to take one step closer to this sort of invisible audience that was at home. So that relationship with the camera is something that can only be developed you know, in community television. I think that's the only way you can do it, unless you're going to a film school or whatever, and you kind of learn, you learn the same things in a more technical way. Yeah, I think that was my original point, was that because I couldn't get into the biz at all, I couldn't get into this television world, but as a writer, you know, that's how I got in. And I was never going to be a performer. I was always going to be a writer. So I thought it was too old to be a performer at that point.
Now that's interesting, given where you are.
It was bad. It was a complete accident. It was great that it happened, but it was, you know, you write things for other people and you give them to people to do. And there are a few things that were coming out saying, "Oh, we don't quite get this," or "This didn't work," or whatever. And I said, "Well, what, you know, okay, that's fine." So, well, why don't you do it? So they just gave me a second unit opportunity to go. When I say second unit, I mean just pretty much a really basic news crew. They said, "Oh, here's a camera and a mic and no lights, and you've got to change in the car." That's very community television. And so the main unit was massive. You know, they had trucks and they had makeup vans, and that was proper like you'd never see now on a TV show. Back in those days, they spent a lot of money making this particular sketch show. But there was this little rinky-dink, you know, half-assed, no direction, basically. It was just somebody who knew how to point the camera at you. And that's when I did all my pretend journalist, TV journalist things. Now I'm doing a report. You just make it, you end up writing material that fits the rather Spartan world that you're presented with, and stuff that's half-assed and daggy. Actually lends itself to that environment. So that's what you tend to do. You kind of, I suppose, you know yourself, you kind of lean into it a bit.
Yeah.
And
because if you pretend it's too much more important and bigger than it is, the audience doesn't go along with you. Whereas if you can lean in a little bit, then they can see that you understand where you're coming from.
And exactly. It's like look, it's no different to doing stand-up where you admit, you know, you basically tell the truth most of the time with a good laugh, because it's a laugh of recognition. So the relationship between a comedian and audience lives or dies on not bullshitting them, essentially.
Yes. Yeah.
And you can have dramatic skills and tricks, and you might know. I don't. I actually have no talent at all. The only reason I'm doing comedy is by default, because I know I there's nothing else I could do. If I could play the piano, I would be playing the piano. If I could dance, I'd be doing. I could sing, sure. But there are people who have comic ability or instinct and all those other things as well. And they're they're incredible to work with. But yeah, when you've got nothing like I have, then maybe my resemblance to a person who sits behind a desk and reads the news is probably the only thing I've got going for me.
You've got to lean into your most marketable skill.
Exactly. Yes.
Look, that's professional, right. Go for it.
I'm an old white guy. I'm playing that role. That's who I am.
No, I respect that. You got to look within and see what works. That's why so many stand-ups start with, like, if they're a redhead, they'll start telling redhead jokes. The audience immediately recognizes this about me, so I will mention it and
I'll get in first.
Yeah, we'll go from there.
I'll say what you're thinking, or what you think you thought.
Yeah,
because the thing is, of course, you're tricking them anyway into thinking that these things are relatable, but of course, you know, most of the time it's just sleight of hand on your part, you know, that you're telling the story that is actually a joke. It was interesting about what was the Hannah Gadsby show, the first one that she did. What was it called?
The one where she was talking about art.
No, the one that made her, where she made her name internationally.
Nanette,
yeah, that's right. So when she did that show, people were you know, it was a great buzz of conversation about whether it was actually comedy or whether it was actually stand-up. I kept thinking, what? This is a pointless conversation. What it is is a great one-person show, one-woman show in this case. But you know, what I marveled at was her ability, her acting ability, the fact that she could put herself in the moment of confession and be so raw. I mean, she's doing it like 1,000 times. There's a lot of skill in recreating those moments. I imagine it would have been a challenge for her anyway, emotionally, because it was obviously coming from such a raw place. But the fact that she took a stand-up, the conceit being that it was a stand-up act that was basically somebody having a nervous breakdown during it. I mean, that was abstracted out, and it wasn't quite that, but you could tell what the idea was. And I thought, well, she's just using the stand-up show as a box to tell the story from. This doesn't have to be a stand-up show. It was very interesting. I think a lot of the reaction, at least initially, maybe people have come around, but I think a lot of the initial reaction was that she was, from comedians, was that she was somehow betraying the secret magical art of stand-up, that what we do is we take our pain and we gut it and we turn it into laughter. And while I'm sure that is true for some bits of material where you kind of smooth things over and you add some things and take out the sting and make it a funny thing, you know, there's no difference between drama. People sometimes express drama and comedy as being, you know, two sides of a coin. It's not. It's actually comedy and tragedy. They're both drama. They're both telling stories. It's just a question of how well you tell the story.
Yeah.
So and the tools, you know, that's the thing about community TV and radio, is that you're just given an opportunity, or you used to be given this opportunity to learn the craft of being able to tell stories in this way, you know, in the way visually, or in the way of being a television show, or the way of being a radio show, or whatever. I'm kind of with you about the regret and the sadness sufficient importance isn't placed on that by those who should be funding it, because it's unless they're opening up free courses at universities and dramatic institutions where those skills are actually taught, and there's, you know, decreasingly more, I don't know. There are fewer opportunities to get that education. So you've got to learn it yourself. And while it's true you can sit at home and work it out with a bit of software and with a computer screen, a lot of people do that very successfully, they might not quite have the same understanding they would have had they gone out in front of an audience, because it's all frustrated theatre, or TV and radio is frustrated theatre with an audience. Because you probably see yourself, you go to the comedy festival and there's these shows with people, who's that? who's that person? I've never heard of that person. Of course, they have a huge audience.
Yeah.
But they've never performed in front of an audience before.
Yep.
It's very strange. And I've gone along to those shows. And there are some who obviously are very skilled, like, say, Andy Donner or something, are enormously skilled theatrically and hilarious and happen to have used, web series and things to get to their audience because they're not on mainstream television, or at least they weren't, when they started. But there are others who have no idea what they're doing when they stand on stage. They're kind of coasting on the celebrity and the recognition that they have with their audience. And maybe that's fine. Maybe I'm not poo-pooing that, but it's not quite the same thing as having learned your craft in front of an audience.
Yeah, having developed
it. And then honed it in community television or radio.
Yeah. You're finding a really nice particular point, a nice shape that your audience is comfortable with and that they are happy to travel along with you, assuming you're speaking in a similar tone or doing a similar thing. I can tell from some of our old hosts used to get just emails from the community, just being wanting to debate them about a particular joke that they'd made and just topics. I'm sure you get endless just because of your wider reach, but for our hosts to come to me and just be like, this man wrote to me and is questioning me about a joke we wrote, I'm not going to respond, but it is interesting the level of engagement that comes from it.
Yeah. When that people make up their own rules about what their relationship is with the person talking to them, and I mean, that's the good thing about social media, I think, is you can, I mean, yes, you can get a letter from them and you can choose to respond or not to, but that's a lot easier with social media. I mean, if you want to find out what a certain hunk of people think about what you've just done, then, you go to the YouTube clip and you look underneath and there's plenty of comments there. And obviously it's kind of more fun in life you can be more amusing by being mean about someone than you can by praising them. So your chances are you're going to get people who are enjoying themselves and maybe pulling you apart or whatever.
Yeah.
And if you're tough enough, that you treat that as what it is, which is kind of nothing really, doesn't really matter. And also if you have the experience and plenty of it in front of an audience and you get that laughter, which is an unmediated and unprocessed reaction to your material, because let's face it, you don't come out on stage to have a conversation with anybody. You're coming out to say, here's my act.
Yeah.
And if you like it, then you will automatically respond in a way that doesn't involve you thinking of it or deciding to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You'll just laugh. And so that's kind of a very pure response. And there's not many forms of art that enable you to get that purity of response straight away. I mean, applause actually requires someone to think, I think well enough of this person to indicate to them with this noise that they're doing this, but that doesn't happen with laughs. Laugh just comes out, and they and you got them straight away. As soon as they've laughed at you, as soon as you get them to laugh, you have won them over. They are literally disarmed. They're your friend or whatever kick you're getting out of that noise that they make, and they like you, in that moment. And I think that's probably why as performers, well, it's certainly why I'm attracted to it. I'm sure it's absolutely linked to that.
Yeah.
Suddenly someone I haven't even bothered to get to know actually likes me. very one-way street performing.
Yeah. That first laugh of the show is just so important, because when it comes, how big it comes, and if it's in roughly the same position every night, because then whether they've signed on, how they felt about their connection, like whether they've laughed surprisingly or reluctantly or boisterously. And then, all right, this is the area we're playing in. These guys were surprised that they enjoyed that. There's going to be a lot of surprises along the way.
Yeah, well, and that's the other thing, is the shape of the laugh that comes to you. And it's not always the same. If you get it at the same moment, I think that's your job, is trying to muster whatever. For whatever reason you're laughing, I'll take any reason at all. But if you're trying to muster them so they're all laughing at the same moment, then of course it's a big laugh, which is more valuable to you. But I'll on TV, and because you're playing to this abstract idea of an audience at home, you're going on instinct to a certain extent. You might be lucky enough to have a studio audience to guide you a little bit. So if you you really lay an egg, you absolutely have no doubt about that. You can do something, you think, I'm not sure that worked, but an audience will
either let you know.
Yeah, they'll let you know pretty quickly. They just won't give you anything.
Yeah.
But you don't get anything, it's not their fault. I was always quite intrigued in the early days when I did hang around with stand-ups just to see how it worked. And they'd come off stage and they'd tell a terrible audience. And well, hang on a minute. It's not like they all got together and decided to be a particular audience. It's more that you as a performer haven't really done your job properly. You didn't get to muster them in the time available, and you didn't sort of take them by the hand lead them behind the curtain, you know, and say, oh, well, here's something that's worth listening to. Yeah. It just wasn't funny. So that's fine.
It is an amazing response and a surprisingly common response. And what baffles me is when they do it on stage. The audacity of that being like, well, that doesn't matter. No, it didn't. Like, clearly it didn't.
What's that English comedian's name who does that? Seems to do that as his shtick. He just deconstructs the show as he's doing it.
Oh, Stuart Lee.
Yeah, Stuart Lee. Lee's really interesting in that way. I mean, I know it's shtick. He's doing shtick, but it does come from him being obviously very smart and probably beating himself up on the way home after early gigs. This is early in his career.
Yeah.
Now he kind of knows what he's doing. But he's always known what he's doing, but he's refined it to a meta art, you know. I think if you're as smart as he is, you can have a go at, he chooses sections of the audience to have a go at, or notional sections of the audience, and then folds it back in on itself. But I have seen meltdowns on stage where someone's quite, I mean, it's fascinating to watch, but it's I'm glad it's not me. Like, I keep going, well, this is really interesting. Again, we get back to Michael Richards, having his meltdown. And that was interesting because I was watching that thinking, I know what you're doing. You're trying to stay in whatever character you pick for yourself, which is kind of vaguely Kramer, but kind of an angry Kramer. And you just double down on this bit of shtick you're doing, and you think you're going to get through it like an actor would, like a method actor would.
Yeah,
and it's not really helping you. I don't think a lot of people read it like that. I think most people who don't know about zones and character and commitment probably just think he's insane.
Yeah,
or was insane in that moment. But I kind of got it. I felt, well, it hasn't worked. And in a room where there weren't cameras or phones, it would have been a bad night, and that would have been
It would have dissipated forever. And
yeah, it would have been like that thing we were talking about earlier, where it's just gone. It's a moment that's, it's a funny story later, but it's not when you film it.
One of those rumors that floats around and be like, did you hear about this?
Yeah.
This evening? Like, do you think it's true?
Yeah. Well, I guess that's the price of fame, isn't it? I mean, if you're that celebrated as a performer and people are coming on to see you for that reason, then there's going to be a weight of attention on you. And in his case, he was kind of learning the ropes to be a stand-up. He wasn't a stand-up. He was a very accomplished physical comedian and fine actor.
Mm.
But that, and late in life, he's decided to go down that road. But it just showed him how difficult it is and how very, very difficult it is. And it's one of the reasons Steve Martin decided to give up stand-up, was because he'd reached a point where the audience wouldn't allow him, he felt, to develop any new material or try anything out. Maybe he felt that pressure. You know, when you've got an audience of 20,000 people in the Universal Amphitheatre and they're all screaming your catchcries at you, it's not the time to go, I'm going to just try this bit out I thought on the way here in the car.
It's hard to have your act yelled back at you, I guess. And just expect anything else to fly that evening. Become the best.
No, you'll do your hits. You'll do your greatest hits and take the money. But I can see how empty that would make some people feel, particularly early on. It can be a trap. Poor trap to be in, I suppose, because they're doing quite well. But I suppose, think of Robin Williams or even Seinfeld still going out on the road. You know, that's pretty phenomenal. Well, interestingly enough, when I saw Seinfeld's last you know, when they kind of do the tour and then they do a Netflix version of it or something. Yep. What seems to be the road ends there. You know, you consolidate all the effort and all the success and all, it's the best version of that particular show that's ever going to be. So let's record it, mm-hmm. put it to air. He was so, the material was so polished and so honed that he almost didn't need to do anything to deliver it.
Yeah.
It was such a flat performance by him because it's such a reductive art, I suppose, because you get to the point where, well, this is the way to do it with the least amount of energy. That's the purest form of this joke is the material. Mm. And that's where he got to. But, you know, it's not as much fun to watch. I'd rather watch him halfway through that run and see a couple of mistakes or just see it looking a little bit raw. You know, I'm just more interested in...
Well, it was definitely interesting comparing the Chris Rock special that would become Tambourine on Netflix compared to the live version that I was fortunate enough to see. Because there were a few little things in there and a few little raw moments. And he was confessional about some of his relationship faux pas in a way that he wasn't on the Netflix special, but because everyone had their phones locked away in these little bags, nobody could film it and nobody could.
Yeah.
And so he could be confessional in a way that
he
would have to take all of our word for it and he could just always deny.
Yeah. But that also feeds into the idea that we in the room have an arrangement. And you have given me permission by laughing at these seven jokes that you're going to let me go a little bit further here.
That's true.
You know, it's a pity that you've got to lock away, put people's phones in some magnetic bag or whatever they do. It's kind of a pity. And then obviously the Netflix version is going to be a more mass audience, less nuanced version of that show. It's going to be a blunter version of the show. I don't know, maybe it feeds into the relationship you have. You've got to go and see the person live. There's a reason to go and see them live because seeing the Netflix special isn't going to be quite the same.
Yeah.
You know, and that, I mean, probably you and I are going to be more interested in some. That's why I like seeing Richard Pryor's old stuff because it is such a, or Billy Connolly, you know, the older guys who didn't really care too much about how things looked or how things landed. And there was no eye on the future or on, exactly. It was, and there's nothing. I mean, it's kind of house lights up. There's no set or scenery. There's no lighting to speak of. There's about, probably about four cameras, one behind him, and it's a couple of different nights. And but for me, there's a visceral quality there. It's like, well, it is more like being there than it is watching these slicker vehicles.
Yeah, that's a really fair observation, I think, of.
It's probably true of TV generally. I mean, the reason I was probably keen to sort of support and get involved peripherally with my writer friends who were doing community TV in Melbourne was because there's something just a little more raw and honest about it. Mm. And it had to go through fewer hands. And when you finally get to, if you're fortunate enough to get the position, not that I think anyone's terribly interested these days in getting to network television in Australia, but when you get to that point, it has to go through so many.
Yeah.
Emissions and doors and things like that, but you, whatever makes you could be knocked off by the time you get there, and you end up, you know, so you can put anybody in the chair and put the suit on them and or whatever, and stick the light on them and the mic under them, and they just get you. There's a risk of it being blanded out.
Mm.
So
there's definitely a huge swath of personality in a lot of community radio, community television, like just going from show to show on stuff that I've worked on, the voices and the people in the room and just the amount of personality that sort of comes out of these productions is incredibly admirable. Like, it's just wonderful to be able to play in those worlds.
Yeah. And I think the support that everyone gives each other too, it's probably a bit more of a generous environment that might be, it's less dog eat dog. It is generally more supportive. It is a bit like, you know, a bunch of people putting on a show rather than a bunch of people competing for an opportunity, which is often, you know, where people end up. And it's, I know that writing for our kind of weekly radio show or writing for our stage shows when I was younger, when money wasn't relevant at all because no one got paid anything, it was, you were there for the, out of the love of it, you know, the comp, for the camaraderie and for the end product, which was performing something in front or for an audience. Whereas my first gig writing in TV, you were paid by minute. I was paid $120 a minute with a guarantee of 30 seconds to air. So I was paid $60 for the opportunity to maybe make $120. That's what I got. But it meant that if you wrote with someone else, you would have to share that minute. So yeah. It discouraged collaboration in a way. Right. Like it wasn't in your financial interest if you were doing it for a living and didn't have another job, which is the situation that a lot of us were in. That was it for us because we were devoting all our time to this thing. Mm-hmm. We might be doing stand-up at night, but it wasn't quite. And you probably earn more money, to be frank, than spending all day writing. But it was instantly a gladiatorial environment for you. Wow. It's completely the opposite. So. Yeah, to have gone straight into the professional business, I would and miss all the other stuff. I would have lost a lot. I think I would have not known what I didn't know, I suppose, but I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't have developed the ability to write with other people or the ability really to perform and support other people on stage.
Yeah, yeah, I do feel like that is such a lost art, but it's such an important stepping stone. It's such a good reminder for performers who, because it can be a bit cutthroaty in the stand-up world, and we're all jostling for the same 5-minute slot and for the same two people in the audience, but it can be a bit like you'll be pushed out and cut out if you're not there and constantly in people's minds and presence, whereas bring a bunch of people who in that environment might be quite cutthroaty, but that come to this writing environment and suddenly we're in a room where everybody pitches and someone's coming in and saying, I like this, but let's, like, what about this? And just being able to foster people when I was in the line producer position and seeing two people click and being like, why don't you guys work on this together? And just watching this beautiful little thing blossom out of two people, and suddenly you've got 3 to 4 minutes of excellent commentary on something that we weren't even sure where it was going to go.
Well, that's an invaluable skill as a producer, to be able to do that dinner party thing of saying, I'll sit this person next to this person because I know that they'll work together. To be able to spot what's going to work when it comes through the door, when those people come through the door and you see them, is a rare skill. There's a lot of executive producers here at the ABC who don't have that, you know, because they maybe came up through publicity or they didn't quite come through the right doors to be able to pick those with talent. I get that. I've had that over a number of years, meeting executives who think writers are just writers. Mm. They don't realise that. They think it's, if we don't get that writer, then what does it matter? You just get another writer. It's like, they're all exactly the same, aren't they? I can't see any different. They're just tone deaf or blind or something to the myriad hues that can be presented to you by a writer and a performer. They go, we'll just get another one.
Yeah.
It's just like changing a tire, isn't it? It's the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. Those treads don't change at all. It's fine.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
In terms of your experience with the community world, I mean, we've covered a fair bit of it, but that transitional leap, like you said, it's sort of like a membrane that you can sort of push your way through if you're
feeling. Well, that's right. I think it's there's the acquisition of skills and craft and I guess managing people and your own expectations. All those things happen because you're not distracted by other things like fame and money and. You know, and if you're driven by those things, you're probably in the wrong business. You're probably that's. I mean, there are people, I guess, who have those as objectives, but I don't. You'll burn yourself out, or you'll end up pretty bitter and cynical, I think, if you go that way. If you're there for the right reasons, I think it's just love. You're just there for the love of whatever joy you get by performing or performing in front of an audience or seeing this thing you've made. enjoyed by people.
Yeah.
It's as simple as watching them open the present and seeing them enjoy themselves. If that's the motivation, then and you're lucky enough to find like-minded people, which you often do in community TV and community theatre and community radio, because that's why you're there. Then yeah, you take a bit of that to to the next stage. Which the more you, there's always someone who gets to the door before you, and it's the case for me. There was my writer friend Gary McCaffrey, who he just said, I'm just going to go and try to get to television. So he went off and he spent like 5 or 6 years sending scripts in while he was working in a sandwich shop, and he finally got them read. And he finally was offered a job. And then at that point, he got me in. So I went straight from a proper job, not having to work in a sandwich shop, him saying, he's at the back door. He's just opened it. He says, I'm in. Come on in. So he got me in through the back door. So that's good. And like, if you're in that environment where you all like each other and you all support each other, that will continue. And you will. You'd say you ring up someone you work with them. On the show that you did in your first, you know, year out of uni or school or whatever, and say, I know the perfect person for this, and that's how you build a good writer's room. And for me, every show I've done on TV has always been built out from the writer's room. It's not necessarily the only way. In fact, I think it's an exception these days to make a TV show like this. But everything,
I would imagine,
good or bad, comes from the writer's room. You know,
yeah,
for me.
No, that makes a lot of sense, because you're getting a cross-section of ideas and voices who come at each idea from their understanding and their experience, and they can, you know, meld those two things with what's in the room, and you can find maybe the most common point of everyone's frustration if it's something that you're looking to satirize or looking to take down.
And you test each other, and you know, so, and again, we get back to what you've mentioned, which is that that environment of kind of trust a bit. You can criticize someone new, you can, and it's not taken personally, and there's nothing else at stake other than what you're making together. If anything survives that transition from the early days of whatever community version of this we're talking about, it's that. Workshop room, or that, in my case, the writer's room, you know, and that's what's been transposed. And it's probably no surprise to you to learn that many of the people I work most closely with, I worked with way back when I was 18 years old on the university shows and also the radio shows I was doing.
It's a very reassuring thing to hear, though, because you can assume it, but it's just so nice to know that it exists and that it carries through.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad.
Because, you see so much of it falling away. And we, even at the moment when we're looking at the taking down of community TV, even though the spectrum will sit unused until 2024, 2025, it's just such a disheartening and disappointing thing to see so much lost potential.
And it gets down to the fact that ministers for communication are like those executive producers I talked about there. They don't understand what can be. It's not the same as being in the room with a camera on your computer. It isn't the same thing. There are so many things that you don't get from that, and the key one is what we've been talking about, which is the ability to collaborate with a lot of people.
It's just such a unique feeling, though, stepping onto the set for the first time as well.
Yeah, sure.
Seeing those cameras. Yeah. That's to feel like you're doing a thing.
And yeah, there's something at stake. I think that's probably the main difference. Yeah.
Absolutely. Whereas you're sitting in your lounge room, your bedroom, in front of a camera, not a lot changes.
Yeah, I mean, it's a thing. It's an absolute thing. And,
and
done well, it's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you know, it shouldn't just be having to do one and not the other. I mean, it's got to be all things. I mean, these days, if anything, you've got to be the master of the number of platforms in order to get your story out there. You've got to be able to do everything. You really do, in this country, have to be able to happily and comfortably wear a number of hats. You can't sit by the phone expecting someone to ring you up as an actor. You've got to be writing your own material to perform as an actor, you know, and you've got to be able to direct your own stuff, and you've got to be able to, I still can't do it, but you've still got to be able to edit your own stuff, and you've got to be able to probably play music, or at least, you know, have access to production discs, or, you know, all those things.
Have a
friend. You've got to be a one-stop shop.
Yeah, or have a friend who you know, knows how to play and is willing. It's willing to lend you their time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the stuff that sort of seems most disappointing to lose, is that the building of what will be, because especially for this government, who have really built their talking points on jobs and growth. I mean, they ran on that at one point, and they're currently very heavily talking about getting people skilled, getting people back into work, skilling them up. And this is where it happens. This is the environment where they learn.
And yes, regrettably, the present government and certainly a Labor government federally would be more sympathetic to the arts community, but it's not regarded, the arts community is not regarded as important unless it's part of a service industry.
Mm.
And even on that sort of reductive, blunt economic level, you could actually make a good case out for supporting the arts.
Absolutely.
But they don't want it. They'll give the support to the people who hammer the sets together, because that feels like labor. Mm. Whereas somebody who sits in a room and thinks about things and decides to throw away half of what they thought that day and finally put down the other half, they seem like a couple of flakes who are probably trying to, you know, bilk the welfare system. You know, they don't see that they don't see the value in what you write is in what you throw away, or the fact that you're. And there used to be a great story about, I think it was Jack Warner, you know, from Warner Brothers Studios, you know, and they used to make the animation unit. And he walked past, and unless he could hear them at the typewriter, he assumed they weren't working. So if the typewriters weren't clapping away, he'd come and say, "What the hell's going on in here?" And that's kind of how our politicians work. They're kind of blunt.
Yeah.
They're blunt, and they don't see the value in it. And ideologically also, they're just not predisposed, because there's no votes from the arts community, because the arts community are more likely than not to be a little bit left.
Weird how that works when you start working.
Yeah, funny that.
And then if you're built on empathy, you start to care.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
That's all right. No, it was nice talking to you.
Yeah, I really quite enjoyed this. This is a good chat.